day. He dialed the number a second time, and once again he could hear the message over the receiver. The bug and the repeater were working perfectly. As he put away his tools, he thought about Gabrielle's contribution to that evening's work. It had lasted precisely 3 seconds by Karp's calculation. He saw none of it. His attention had remained fixed on his work, but he had heard the whole thing. There had been 4 sharp blows. The last was the most vicious. Karp was sure he had heard bone shattering. He had looked down only after he finished the installation and closed the box. He would never forget the sight. Gabriel Allon, bending over each of his victims, tenderly checking each throat for a pulse, making certain he hadn't killed them. In the morning, while Karp slept, Gabriel composed a coded message inside a copy of the Times. Then he walked to Marble Arch and entered the underground. He stopped only to make a brief telephone call before he passed through the turnstiles, and 15 minutes later he arrived at Waterloo. Shamron's Bodel was waiting in a café in the Eurostar ticket terminal, holding a plastic shopping bag bearing the name of an American cigarette. Gabriel sat at the next table, drinking tea and reading the newspaper. When he finished his tea, he stood and walked away, leaving the newspaper behind. The Bodel slipped it into the shopping bag and headed in the opposite direction. Gabriel waited in the terminal for his train to be called. 10 minutes later, he boarded the Eurostar for Paris. Amsterdam. The elegant canal house stood on the Herengracht in the golden curve of Amsterdam's central canal ring. It was tall and wide, with large windows overlooking the canal and a soaring gable. The owner, David Morgenthau, was the multimillionaire chairman of Optiek, one of the world's largest makers of designer eyeglasses. He was also a passionate Zionist. Over the years, he had given millions of dollars to Israeli charities and invested millions more in Israeli businesses. An American of Dutch-Jewish descent, Morgenthau had served on the boards of several New York Jewish organizations and was regarded as a hawk when it came to matters of Israeli security. He and his wife Cynthia, a renowned New York interior designer, visited their home in Amsterdam like clockwork twice each year. Once in the summer, on the way to their villa outside Cannes, and once again in the winter for the holidays. Tariq sat in a café on the opposite side of the canal, drinking warm, sweet tea. He knew other things about David Morgenthau, things that did not appear in the society pages or the world's business journals. He knew that Morgenthau was a personal friend of the Israeli Prime Minister, that he had performed certain favors for Ari Shamron, and that he had once served as a secret conduit between the Israeli government and the PLO. For all those reasons, Tariq was going to kill him. Leila had prepared a detailed surveillance report during her stay in Amsterdam. David and Cynthia Morgenthau left the house each morning to visit museums or go ice skating in the countryside. During the day, the only person who remained in the house was a maid, a young Dutch girl. Tariq thought, "This is going to be too easy." A chauffeured Mercedes braked to a halt outside the house. Tariq looked at his watch. 4 p.m., right on schedule. A tall, gray-haired man climbed out. Then a moment later, an attractive woman in black stretch leggings and a pullover. As they entered the house, the Mercedes drove off. Tariq left a few guilders on the table, and as he started back toward the houseboat on the Amstel, he thought about what Kamel had told him during their meeting on the train. Tariq's old nemesis, Gabriel Allon, had been brought back to help Ari Shamron find him. The news did not concern him. Indeed, he welcomed it. It would make the next few weeks even sweeter. Imagine destroying their so-called peace process and settling his score with Gabriel Allon all at the same time. Killing Allon would not be easy, but as Tariq drifted along the banks of the Herengracht, he realized he held a distinct advantage simply by virtue of knowing that Allon was out there searching for him. The hunter must come to the prey to make the kill. If Tariq played the game well, he could draw Allon into a trap. "And then I'll kill him, the way he killed Mahmoud." Intelligence services have two basic ways of trying to catch a terrorist, he reasoned. They can use their superior technology to intercept the terrorist's communications, or they can penetrate his organization by inserting a spy or convincing an existing operative to switch sides. Tariq and Kamel were careful about the way they communicated. They avoided telephones. They used couriers instead, like the idiot Kamel sent to Samos. No, they would not be able to track him by intercepting his communications, so they would have to try to penetrate his group. For this reason, Tariq had instructed Kamel to contact every agent and give one simple instruction. If any of them noticed anything out of ordinary, such as surveillance or an approach by a stranger, they were to report it immediately. Tariq came to the river and walked along the embankment to the houseboat. It was a depressing place, dirty, filled with drug and sexual paraphernalia, but a perfect spot to hide while he planned the attack. He crossed the deck, entered the cabin, and turned on the little electric space heater. In the bedroom, he could hear the girl stirring beneath her blankets. She was a pathetic wretch, not like the girl he had stayed with in Paris. No one would miss this one when she was gone. Perhaps no one would miss him very much either. Tariq felt another one of the headaches coming on. They were coming more frequently now, 3, sometimes 4 a week. The doctor had warned it would happen that way. The pain slowly intensified now until he was nearly blinded by it. But he would take no painkillers. The painkillers dulled his senses. They made him sleep too heavily. They gave him the sensation of tumbling backward through an abyss. He simply lay down and waited, though it felt as if someone was pouring molten lead into his skull. Valbonne, Provence. At the end of a terrace of cottages overlooking the town parking lot was a commercial building. Jacqueline Delacroix got down off of her Bianchi racing bike and peered through the dirty glass window of the vacant commercial space. The room, she could see, was large and open with wood floors and a high ceiling, perfect for a dance studio. Her idea this morning, not quite a plan yet but more than a fantasy, was that she would quit modeling and open a ballet school. While she was at it, she would probably become Sarah Halevy again. Sarah Halevy, the Jewish girl from Marseille. But to open the school she needed money, and to get money she would have to keep modeling for a while. She mounted her bike again. The villa she rode home to was a rather small one, but it was hidden from view by a row of towering cypress trees, and rosemary and lavender grew wild among the olive and drooping pepper trees in the garden. At the base of the garden was a rectangular swimming pool. Jacqueline let herself inside, propped the bike in the entrance hall, and went into the kitchen. She pressed the playback button on her answering machine. Yvonne had called to invite her to a party at the home of a millionaire Spanish tennis player in Monte Carlo. Michel Duval had called to apologize for his behavior at the shoot the other day. The bruise was healing nicely. Marcel had called to say that he had spoken to Robert. The shoot in Moustique was back on.
You leave in 3 weeks, Angel, so get off the cheese and pasta and get your beautiful ass in shape. Oh, by the way, a fellow called Jean-Claude came by the office. Said he wanted to talk to you personally about a job.
Jacqueline had started to make coffee. She stopped.
I told him you were in the south. He said he was on his way there and that he would look you up when he arrived.
She pressed the rewind button and listened to the message again to make certain she had heard it right.
Oh, by the way, a fellow called Jean-Claude came by the office. Said he wanted to talk to you personally about a job.
She pressed the erase button, hand trembling, heart beating against her ribs. Jacqueline sat outside on the sunlit terrace, thinking about the night she was recruited by Ari Shamron. She had used some of her money from modeling to buy her parents a retirement present, a small beachfront apartment in Herzliya. She visited them in Israel whenever she could get away for a few days. She fell completely in love with the country. It was the only place she felt truly free and safe. More than anything else, she loved the fact that she did not have to conceal her being Jewish. One evening, in a jazz cafe in Tel Aviv, an older man appeared at her table, bald, rather ugly, steel-rimmed glasses, khaki trousers.
"Hello, Sarah," he said, smiling confidently. "May I join you?"
She looked up, startled.
"How did you know my name is Sarah?"
"Actually, I know a great deal about you. I am a big fan."
"Who are you?"
"My name is Ari. I work for an organization loosely connected to the Ministry of Defense called the Institute for Coordination. We just call it the office."
"Well, I'm certainly glad we cleared that up." He threw back his head and laughed.
"We'd like to talk to you about a job. Your French passport and, quite frankly, your appearance could make you very helpful to us."
"Are you asking me to become a spy?"
He laughed.
"I'm afraid it's nothing quite so dramatic as that."
"What do you want me to do?"
"I want you to become a bat leveya."
"I'm sorry, but I don't speak Hebrew."
"No, of course not. Bat leveya is the term we use for a female assistant agent. As a bat leveya, you might be called on to perform a number of functions for the office. Sometimes you might be asked to pose as the wife or girlfriend of one of our male officers. Sometimes you might be asked to obtain a vital piece of information that a woman like you might get more readily than a male officer."
He stopped talking for a moment and took his time lighting a cigarette.
"And sometimes we may ask you to perform another kind of assignment, an assignment that some women find too unpleasant to even consider."
"For example?"
"We might ask you to seduce a man, one of our enemies, for instance, in order to place him in a compromising situation."
"There are lots of beautiful women in Israel. Why on earth would you need me?"
"Because you're not an Israeli. Because, as I've said, you have a legitimate French passport, and because you also have a legitimate job."
"That legitimate job, as you call it, pays me a great deal. I'm not prepared to throw it away."
"If you decide to work for us, I'll see that your assignments are brief and that you are compensated for lost wages."
He smiled affectionately.
"Although I don't think I can afford your usual fee of $5,000 an hour."
"I have to think about it."
"I understand, but as you consider my offer, keep one thing in mind. If there had been an Israel during the Second World War, your grandparents Maurice and Rachel Halevi might still be alive. It's my job to ensure the survival of the state, so the next time some madman decides to turn our people into soap, they'll have a place to take refuge. I hope you'll help me."
He gave her a card with a telephone number and told her to call him with a decision the following afternoon. Then he shook her hand and walked away. It was the hardest hand she had ever felt. There had never been a question in her mind what her answer would be. She returned to Europe for the fall fashion season. She had commitments in Paris, Milan, and Rome. And in November, when things quieted down, she told Marcel Lambert she was burned out and needed a break. Marcel cleared her calendar, kissed her cheek, and told her to get as far away from Paris as possible. That night she went to the LL counter at Charles de Gaulle, picked up the first-class ticket Shamron had left for her, and boarded a flight for Tel Aviv. Her next several weeks were spent in the office's crash course in tradecraft and doctrine. Shamron himself lectured her on the basics of impersonal communication. He trained her to use a Beretta and to cut strategic slits in her clothing so she could grab it in a hurry. He taught her how to pick locks and how to make imprints of keys using a special device. He taught her how to detect and shake surveillance. Each afternoon she spent 2 hours with a man named Oded, who taught her rudimentary Arabic. But most of the time at the academy was spent developing her memory and awareness. Shamron placed her alone in a room and flashed dozens of names on a projection screen, forcing her to memorize as many as possible. He took her into a small apartment, allowed her to look at the room for a matter of seconds, then pulled her out and made her describe it in detail. He took her to lunch at the canteen and asked her to describe the steward who had just served them. Jacqueline confessed she had no idea.
You must be aware of your surroundings all the time, he said. You must assume that the waiter is a potential enemy. You must be scanning, watching, and surveying constantly. And yet you must appear as though you are doing nothing of the sort.
Her training did not stop at sundown, either. One evening, Shamron took her to a lawyer's office, told her to break in and steal a specific set of files. He took her to a street filled with fashionable boutiques and told her to steal something.
You're joking.
What if you are on the run in a foreign country? What if you have no money and no way to make contact with us? The police are looking for you, and you need a change of clothing quickly.
I'm not exactly built for shoplifting.
Make yourself inconspicuous.
She entered a boutique and spent 10 minutes trying on clothing. When she returned to the lobby, she had bought nothing, but inside her handbag was a sexy black cocktail dress. Shamron said,
Now I want you to find a place to change and discard your other clothing. Then meet me outside at the ice cream stand on the promenade.
It was a warm evening for early November, and there were many people out strolling and taking in the air. They walked arm in arm along the waterfront, like a rich old man and his mistress, Jacqueline playfully licking an ice cream cone.
Just one more assignment for you tonight, Shamron said at last. You see that man sitting alone over there?
Jacqueline nodded.
Strike up a conversation with him, learn everything you can, and then entice him back to your flat. When you get to the lobby, find some way of unsnarling yourself from the situation without making a scene.
The day he put her on the plane back to her real life, Shamron kissed her on the cheek.
Sarah Halevi, you're a natural, he said.
Her first assignment didn't require her to leave Paris. The office was trying to recruit an Iraqi nuclear weapons scientist who lived in Paris and worked with Iraq's French suppliers. Shamron decided to set a honey trap and gave the job to Jacqueline. She met the Iraqi in a bar, seduced him, and began spending the night at his apartment. He fell head over heels in love. Jacqueline told her lover that if he wanted to continue seeing her, he would have to meet with a friend of hers who had a business proposition. The friend turned out to be Ari Shamron, the proposition simple. Work for us, or we will tell your wife and Saddam's security thugs you've been fucking an Israeli agent. The Iraqi agreed to work for Shamron. Jacqueline had been given her first taste of intelligence work. She found it exhilarating. She had played a small role in an operation that had dealt a blow to Iraq's nuclear ambitions. She had helped protect the State of Israel from an enemy that would do anything to destroy it. And in a small way, she had avenged the deaths of her grandparents. She had to wait another year for her next assignment, seducing and blackmailing a Syrian intelligence officer in London. It was another stunning success. 9 months later, she was sent to Cyprus to seduce a German chemical company executive who was selling his wares to Libya. This time, there was a twist. Shamron wanted her to drug the German and photograph the documents in his briefcase while he was unconscious. Once again, she pulled off the job without a hitch. After the operation, Shamron flew her to Tel Aviv, presented her with a secret citation, told her she was finished. It didn't take long for things to circulate through the intelligence underground. Her next target might suspect that the pretty French model was more than she appeared to be, and she might very well end up dead. She begged him for one more job. Shamron reluctantly agreed. 3 months later, he sent her to Tunis. Jacqueline had thought it was strange that Shamron instructed her to meet Gabriel Allon in a church in Turin. She found him standing atop a platform, restoring a fresco depicting the Ascension. She worked with good-looking men every day in her overt life, but there was something about Gabriel that took her breath away. It was the intense concentration in his eyes. Jacqueline wanted him to look at her the way he was looking at the fresco. She decided she was going to make love to this man before the operation was over. They traveled to Tunis the following morning and checked into a hotel on the beach. For the first few days he left her alone while he worked. He would return to the hotel each evening. They would have dinner, stroll the souk or the corniche along the beach, then go back to their room. They would talk like lovers in case the room was bugged. He slept in his clothing, stayed rigorously on his side of the bed. A wall of plexiglass separated them. On the fourth day, he took her with him while he worked. He showed her the beach where the commandos would come ashore and the villa owned by the target. Her passion for him deepened. Here was a man who had devoted his life to defending Israel from its enemies. She felt insignificant and frivolous by comparison. She also found that she couldn't take her eyes off him. She wanted to run her hands through his hair, touch his face and his body. As they lay in bed together that night, she rolled on top of him without warning and kissed his lips. He pushed her away from him. "I want to make love to you too," he whispered into her ear. "But I can't. I'm married." "I don't care. When the operation is over, you'll never see me again." "I know." When he gave in to her, he was just as she had imagined, skilled and artful and gentle. In his hands she felt like one of his paintings, and she felt a stupid pride that she had been able to break through his walls of self-control and seduce him. She wanted the operation to go on forever. It couldn't, of course, and the night they left Tunis was the saddest of her life. After Tunis, she threw herself into her modeling. She told Marcel to accept every offer that came in. She worked non-stop for 6 months, pushing herself to the point of exhaustion. She even tried dating other men. None of it worked. She thought about Gabrielle and Tunis constantly. For the first time in her life, she felt obsession, yet she was absolutely helpless to do anything about it. At her wit's end, she went to Shamron and asked him to put her in touch with Gabrielle. He refused. She began to have a terrible fantasy about the death of Gabrielle's wife, and when Shamron told her what had happened in Vienna, she felt unbearable guilt. She had not seen or spoken to Gabrielle since that night in Tunis. She couldn't imagine why he would want to see her now. But 1 hour later, as she watched his car pulling into her drive, she felt a smile spreading across her face. She thought, "Thank God you're here, Gabrielle, because I can use a little restoration myself." Tel Aviv. The CIA's executive director, Adrian Carter, was a man who was easily underestimated. It was a trait he had used to great effect during his long career. He was short and thin as a marathoner. His sparse hair and rimless spectacles gave him a slightly clinical air. His trousers and blazer looked like they'd been slept in. Ari Shamron had worked with Carter, though. He knew Carter was a seasoned operative, a man who spoke 6 languages fluently and could melt into the back alleys of Warsaw or Beirut with equal ease. He also knew that his talents in the field were matched only by his skills in the bureaucratic trenches. A worthy opponent indeed. "Any breaks on the Paris investigation?" Shamron shook his head slowly.
"I'm afraid not."
"Nothing at all, Ari?" "I find that difficult to believe."
"The moment we hear anything, you'll be the first to know. And what about you? Any interesting intercepts you'd care to share? Any friendly Arab services tell you anything they'd be reluctant to share with the Zionist entity?"
Carter had just completed a 2-week regional tour, conferring with intelligence chiefs from the Persian Gulf to North Africa. King Saul Boulevard was his last stop.
"Nothing, I'm afraid," he said. "But we've heard a few whispers from some of our other sources."
Shamron raised an eyebrow.
"Oh, really?"
"They tell us that the word on the street is that Tariq was behind the attack in Paris."
"Tariq has been quiet for some time. Why would he pull something like Paris now?"
"Because he's desperate," Carter said. "Because the two sides are getting closer to a deal, and Tariq would like nothing better than to spoil the party. And because Tariq sees himself as a man of history, and history is about to pass him by."
"It's an interesting theory, but we've seen no evidence to suggest Tariq was involved."
If you did receive such evidence, you'd share it with us, of course.
Of course.
I don't need to remind you that an American citizen was murdered along with your ambassador. The president has made a promise to the American people that her killer will be brought to justice. I plan to help him keep that promise.
You can count on the support of this service, Shamron said piously.
If it was Tariq, we'd like to find him and bring him to the United States for trial. But we won't be able to do that if he turns up dead someplace filled with 22 caliber bullet holes.
Adrian, what are you trying to say to me?
What I'm saying is that the man in the big White House on Pennsylvania Avenue wants the situation handled in a civilized fashion. If it turns out Tariq was the one who killed Emily Parker in Paris, he wants him tried in an American courtroom. No eye-for-an-eye bullshit on this one, Ari. No back-alley execution. Am I making myself clear?
You are making yourself very clear indeed, Ari Shamron answered.
It took Ari Shamron only a couple of minutes to brief the Prime Minister on his meeting with Carter, and when he had completed his narrative, he said,
I need to know if you still want me to carry out the operation under these new circumstances.
And I, said the Prime Minister, need to know whether you can carry out the operation without the CIA finding out about it.
I can.
Then do it, and don't fuck it up.
Vauban, Provence. Jacqueline made sandwiches, placed them on a tray, and carried them into the living room, where Gabrielle was trying to get a fire going in the fireplace. For years she had imagined a scene like this. In a sense, she had made this room for Gabrielle, decorated it in a way she imagined he might like, the stone floor, the rustic rugs, the comfortable furnishings. She placed the tray on the coffee table and sat down on the couch. Gabrielle sat next to her and spooned sugar into his coffee.
Yes, this is how it would be if we had ended up together.
A simple meal, a stroll through an ancient hill town, perhaps a drive down to Cannes to take in a film at the cinema.
Stop it, Jacqueline.
Gabrielle said, I'm working for the office again, and I need your help.
So it was just business after all. Gabrielle had been pulled back in, and he needed her for a job. He was going to pretend the past had never happened. Perhaps it was easier that way.
Ari told me you'd left the office.
He asked me to come back for one job. You know how Shamron can be when he wants something.
I remember, Jacqueline said. Listen, Gabrielle, I don't quite know how to say this, so I'll just say it. I'm very sorry about what happened in Vienna.
He looked away, his eyes cold and expressionless. Clearly, Leah was off limits. Jacqueline had seen a photograph of her once. Gabrielle's wife looked just the way she had imagined, a dark-haired Sabra, brimming with the kind fire and confidence that Jacqueline had longed to possess when she was a Jew growing up in France. The fact that he had chosen a woman like Leah had only made Jacqueline love Gabrielle more. He abruptly changed the subject.
I assume you heard about the attack on our ambassador in Paris.
Of course, it was terrible.
Shamron is convinced Tariq was behind the attack.
And he wants you to find him?
Gabrielle nodded.
Why you, Gabrielle? You've been out of the game so long. Why not use one of his other calzas?
In case you haven't noticed, the office has had more disasters than successes lately.
Tariq has managed to stay one step ahead of the office for years. How are you supposed to find him now?
Shamron has identified one of his agents in London. I've put a tap on his telephone at work, but I need to bug his flat so I can find out who he's talking to and what he's saying. If we're lucky, we might be able to learn where Tariq is planning to strike next.
Why do you need me?
I need you to help me get inside his flat.
He stiffened his back and added,
Yusuf likes women. He enjoys the London nightlife. If you meet him in a bar or a disco, I guarantee he'll invite you home with him.
She sighed.
Sorry, Gabrielle, I'm not interested. Let Ari give you one of his new girls. But you're the best, he answered her, and I trust you.
I have to go to the Caribbean for a shoot in 3 weeks.
I'll only need you for a few days.
I'm not going to do this for nothing.
She looked toward the ceiling, calculating how much she would need. Rent, renovations, advertising.
50,000 is what I'm going to ask.
Francs?
Don't be ridiculous, Gabrielle. Dollars.
He pulled his face into a frown. Jacqueline crossed her arms defiantly.
50,000, or you can call Shamron and ask him for a new girl.
50,000, he said.
Jacqueline telephoned Marcel Lambert in Paris and told him she was going to need 2 more weeks of liberty.
Tell me about this Youssef,
Jacqueline said, as they drove along the winding mountains highway late that afternoon.
He grew up in Beirut, in the Shatila refugee camp.
Jesus, Jacqueline said, closing her eyes.
His parents were refugees in 48. They used to live in the Arab village of Lida, but during the war they fled across the border to Lebanon. They stayed in the south for a while, then moved to Beirut in search of work.
How did he end up in London?
An uncle brought him to England. He made sure Youssef was educated and learned to speak perfect English and French. Once a year, the uncle would send him back to Lebanon to visit. He became a political radical. He felt Arafat and the PLO had surrendered. He supported the Palestinian leaders who wanted to continue the war until Israel was erased from the map. He came to the attention of Tariq's organization. He's been an active member for several years.
Sounds charming.
He is, actually.
Any hobbies?
He likes Palestinian poetry and European women. And he helps Tariq kill Israelis.
At a patch of cleared land, away from any houses, he stopped the car and shut off the engine. He reached into Jacqueline's handbag and took out her Beretta and spare clip. Then he grabbed one of her glossy fashion magazines and ripped off the front and back covers.
Get out, he said. It's time for target practice.
Amsterdam. Tariq spent the afternoon running errands. He walked from the houseboat to Central Station, where he purchased a first-class ticket for the evening train to Antwerp. From the train station, he walked to the red-light district and wandered the labyrinth of narrow alleys until a drug dealer pulled him aside and offered him heroin. Tariq haggled over the price, then asked for enough for 3 people to trip. Tariq gave him the money and slipped the drugs into his pocket. He returned to the houseboat then and found the girl still in bed, just barely awake. He held up the bags of white powder. She smiled.
My way of thanking you for being such a gracious host, he said.
He went into the galley, dug a spoon from the drawer, and lit a candle. He heated the drug over the flame, but instead of diluting 1 bag of heroin into the mixture, he used all 3. When he finished, he drew the liquid into a syringe and carried it back into the forward cabin. Inga was sitting on the edge of the bed now. She had tied a length of rubber above her elbow and was probing the bruises along the inside of her forearm, looking for a suitable vein.
That one looks like it will do, Tariq said.
He handed her the syringe, then looked away as she inserted the needle into her arm and drew back the plunger. In a moment, the drug had begun to course through her body. Tariq turned again and watched approvingly. And then suddenly she looked up at him, eyes wide.
Hey, Paul, man, what's going...
She fell backward onto the bed, body shuddering with violent convulsions, the empty needle dangling from her arm. Tariq walked calmly to the galley and made coffee while he waited for the girl to finish dying. 5 minutes later, as he was packing his things into a small overnight bag, he felt the boat rock sharply. He looked up, stunned. Someone was on the deck. Within seconds, the door opened, and a large, powerfully built man entered the salon. He had blonde hair and studs in both ears. Tariq thought he bore a vague resemblance to Inga. Instinctively, he felt for his Makarov pistol, which was tucked inside his trousers at the small of his back. The man looked at Tariq.
Who are you?
I am a friend of Inge's. I've been staying here for a few days."
He spoke calmly, trying to gather his thoughts. The suddenness of the man's appearance had thrown him completely off guard. 5 minutes ago he had quietly dispensed with the girl. Now he was confronted with someone who could wreck everything. Then he thought,
"If I'm truly Inge's friend, I have nothing to fear."
He forced himself to smile and hold out his hand.
"My name is Paul."
The intruder ignored Tariq's hand.
"I'm Martin, Inge's brother."
"Where is she?"
Tariq motioned toward the bedroom.
"You'll know how Inge can be. Still sleeping."
He realized he had left the door open.
"Let me close her door so we don't wake her. I've just made coffee. Would you like a cup?"
But Martin walked past him and entered Inge's room. Tariq thought, "Damn it." He was shocked at how quickly things had spun out of control. He realized he had about 5 seconds to decide how he was going to kill the man. The easiest thing to do, of course, was to shoot him, but that would have consequences. Murder by handgun was almost unheard of in the Netherlands. A dead girl with a syringe sticking from her arm was one thing, but two dead bodies, one of them filled with 9mm rounds, was quite another. There would be a major investigation. The police would question the occupants of the surrounding houseboats. Someone might remember his face. They would give a description to the police. The police would give a description to Interpol. Interpol would give a description to the Jews. Every policeman and security official in Western Europe would be looking for him. He looked over his shoulder into the kitchen. He remembered that in the drawer next to the propane stove was a large knife. If he killed Inge's brother with a knife, it might look like a crime of passion or an ordinary street crime. But Tariq found the idea of killing someone with a knife utterly repulsive. And there was another, more serious problem. There was a good chance he might not kill him with the first blow. The illness had already begun to take a toll on him. He had lost strength and stamina. The last thing he wanted to do was find himself in a life-or-death struggle with a bigger, stronger opponent. He saw his dreams of destroying the peace process and finally evening the score with Gabriel Alon evaporating, all because Inga's big brother had come home at an inopportune moment. Layla should have chosen more carefully. Tariq heard Martin scream. He decided he had to shoot him. He did it with a single bullet, and he didn't even have the silencer on the gun. The silencer was in the pocket of his coat, and the coat was on a chair in the bedroom. Tariq worked quickly now. He slipped the Makarov back into his waistband, grabbed his suitcase and the spent cartridge, and stepped out of the salon onto the aft deck. Dusk had fallen. Snow was drifting over the Amstel. In a darkened spot along the embankment, he dropped his suitcase into the river. The splash was nearly inaudible. But even if the police did discover the bag, there was nothing in it that could be traced to him. He would purchase a change of clothing and a new case when he arrived in Antwerp. Then he thought, "If I arrive in Antwerp." He followed the Herengracht westward across the city, stopping only to purchase an extravagant bouquet of flowers. When he reached the Morgenthau house, he climbed the front steps, reached out, and pressed the bell. A moment later, the door was opened by a young girl in a maid's uniform. He held out the flower arrangement and said in Dutch, "A gift for the Morgenthaus."
"Oh, how lovely."
"It's quite heavy. Shall I bring it inside for you?"
"Danke."
The girl stepped aside so Tariq could pass. She closed the door to keep out the cold and waited with one hand on the latch for Tariq to place the flowers on a table in the entrance hall and leave. He set down the flowers and drew the Makarov while turning around. This time, the silencer was screwed into place. The girl opened her mouth to scream. Tariq shot her twice in the throat. He dragged the body out of the entrance hall and used a towel from the bathroom to wipe up the trail of blood. Then he sat in the darkened dining room and waited for David and Cynthia Morgenthau to come home. Paris. Shamron summoned Gabriel to the Tuileries Gardens the following morning for a crash meeting. Gabriel found him seated on a bench next to a gravel footpath, surrounded by a gang of pigeons. He wore a slate-gray silk scarf around his neck, with the ends tucked neatly beneath the lapels of his black overcoat, so that his bald head seemed to be mounted atop a pedestal. He stood up, removed a black leather glove from his right hand, and stuck it out like a trench knife. Gabriel found his palm unusually warm and damp. Shamron blew into the throat of the glove and quickly put it back on. He was not accustomed to cold climates, and Paris in winter depressed him. They walked quickly, not like two men talking in a park, but like two men going somewhere in a hurry. Along the footpaths of the Tuileries, across the windswept no-man's land of the traffic circle on the Place de la Concorde. Dead leaves rattled at their feet as they marched along the tree-lined sidewalk next to the Champs-Élysées.
"We received a report this morning from a Sayan in the Dutch Security Service," Shamron said. "It was Tariq who killed David Morgenthau and his wife in Amsterdam."
"How can they be so certain?"
"They're not certain, but I am. The Amsterdam police discovered a dead girl on a houseboat in the Amstel. She had overdosed on heroin. Her brother was dead, too."
"Heroin?"
"A single bullet through the eye."
"What happened?"
"According to the girl's neighbors, an Arab woman moved into the houseboat a couple of weeks ago. She left a couple of days ago, and a man took her place, a Frenchman who called himself Paul."
"So Tariq sent an agent to Amsterdam ahead of time to secure safe lodging and a girl for cover.
And when he was finished with her, he fed her enough heroin to kill a camel. The police say the girl had a history of drug use and prostitution. Obviously, he thought he could make it look like an accidental overdose."
"How did the brother end up dead?"
"The houseboat is registered in his name. According to the police, he's been working in Rotterdam on a construction project. Maybe he appeared on the scene unannounced while Tariq was killing his sister."
"Makes sense."
"Actually, there's evidence to support that theory. A couple of the neighbors heard the gunshot. If Tariq had been planning to kill the brother, he would have used a quieter method of execution. Maybe he was surprised."
"Have they compared the slug from the brother with the slugs taken from the Morgenthaus and the maid?"
"It's a perfect match. Same gun killed all four people."
A young Swedish couple was posing for a photograph. Gabriel and Shamron turned abruptly and walked the other way. Gabriel said, "Any other news?"
"I want you to watch your step in London. A man from Langley paid a courtesy call on me last week. The Americans have been told by their sources that Tariq was involved in Paris. They want him arrested and prosecuted in the United States."
"You got to her?" Shamron asked, changing the subject. Gabriel nodded.
"And she's willing to do it?"
Gabriel nodded again. He stopped in front of a cafe, where Jacqueline was seated in the window. For a moment, she looked up from her magazine, then immediately went back to it. Shamron said,
"It's nice to see you two working together again. Just don't break her heart this time. She's a good girl."
"I know."
"You'll need a cover job for her in London. I know someone who's looking for a secretary."
"I'm one step ahead of you."
Shamron smiled and walked away. He melted into the crowds along the Champs-Élysées and a moment later was gone. At 3:30 that afternoon, Julian Isherwood groped his way back to his gallery from lunch. Julian was drunk. He hadn't noticed that he was drunk until he stepped out the door of Green's and took a few deep breaths of the freezing, damp air. The oxygen had resuscitated his brain, and his brain had alerted his body that, once again, he had poured too much wine into it. His lunchmate had been the tubby Oliver Dimbleby, and once again the topic of conversation had been Oliver's proposal to buy out Isherwood Fine Arts. This time, Isherwood had managed to maintain his composure and discuss the situation somewhat rationally, though not without the assistance of two bottles of superb Sancerre. When one is discussing the dismemberment of one's business, one's very soul, he thought, one is allowed to dull the pain with good French wine. Julian unlocked the gallery door now, pushed the door back, removed his coat, and hung it on the hook in the anteroom. Then he stepped into his office and flipped the light switch. "Hello, Julian." Isherwood spun around and found himself face to face with Gabriel Allon.
"You? How the bloody hell did you get in here?"
"Do you really want to know?"
"I suppose not," said Isherwood.
"What in God's name are you doing here? And where have you been?"
"I need a favor."
"You need a favor? You need a favor from me? You ran out on me in the middle of a job. You left my Vecellio in a Cornish cottage with no security."
"Sometimes the best place to hide a priceless Vecellio is the last place anyone would think to look for it. Look, Julian, I think you'll really like this girl I have for you. She's smart. She'll be invaluable to you in the office."
"That's comforting. Am I allowed to ask why I'm supposed to hire this woman?"
"Julian, please."
"Julian, please. Julian, mind your own business. Julian, shut up and do as we tell you. It's always the same with you people. And all the while, my business is going straight to hell. Oliver's made me an offer. I'm going to take him up on it."
"Oliver doesn't seem like your type."
"Beggars can't be choosers. I wouldn't be in this position if you hadn't run out on me."
"I didn't run out on you."
"What do you call it, Gabriel?"
"It's just something I need to do. It's just like the old days."
"In the old days, that was part of the arrangement going in. But these aren't the old days. This is business. Straight fucking business, Gabriel, and you've given me the right royal shaft. What am I supposed to do about the Vecellio while you're playing games with Ari?"
"Wait for me," Gabriel said. "This will be over soon, and I'll work day and night on it until it's finished."
"I don't want a crash job. I brought it to you because I knew you would take your time and do it right. If I wanted a crash job, I could have hired a hack to do it for a third of what I'm paying you."
"Give me some time. Keep your buyer at bay, and whatever you do, don't sell out to Oliver Dimbleby. You'll never forgive yourself."
Isherwood looked at his watch.
"I have an appointment. Someone who actually wants to buy a picture."
He made an effort to straighten his tie.
"By the way, you left a broken-hearted little boy behind in Cornwall."
"Peel," Gabriel said distantly.
"It's funny, Gabriel, but I never had you figured for the type that would hurt a child. Tell your girl to be at the gallery at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and tell her not to be late."
"She'll be there."
"What am I to call this secretary you're sending me?"
"You may call her Dominique."
"Good looking?"
Isherwood said, regaining a bit of his old humor.
"Not bad."
Maida Vale, London. Gabrielle carried the suitcases in while Jacqueline surveyed her new home, a cramped bedsit flat with a single window overlooking an inner courtyard and less than basic furnishings. Jacqueline felt depressed.
"Couldn't you have found something a little bit nicer?"
"Dominique Bonnard is a girl from Paris who came to London in search of work. I didn't think a three-bedroom maisonette in Mayfair was appropriate. But don't worry, we'll start the operation tomorrow night. You'll be out of here in a week."
She lit a cigarette, threw back her head, blew smoke at the ceiling. Then she looked at Gabrielle and narrowed her eyes.
"Do you remember that night in Tunis?"
"Which night?"
"The night of the operation."
"Of course I remember it."
"I remember it as though it were yesterday. How is it Shamron enticed you back after all these years?"
"It has nothing to do with Shamron. It's about Tariq."
"What about Tariq?"
"It was Tariq who planted the bomb in my car in Vienna. Tariq had an older brother, Mahmoud, who was a member of Black September. Ari Shamron sent me to kill him in Cologne, Germany. And 17 years later, Tariq took his revenge by blowing up my wife and son right before my eyes."
Jacqueline covered her mouth with her hands. Gabrielle went and looked out the window into the courtyard.
"For a long time I thought Tariq had made a mistake," Gabrielle said. "But he never makes mistakes like that. He's careful, deliberate.
He's the perfect predator. He went after my family for a reason. He went after them to punish me for killing his brother. He knew it would be worse than death. He turned to face her. From one professional to another, it was an exquisite piece of work.
And now you're going to kill him in return?
He looked away again and said nothing.
I always blamed myself for what happened in Vienna, Jacqueline said. If we hadn't...
It wasn't your fault, Gabriel said, cutting her off. It was my fault, not yours. I should have known better. I behaved foolishly. But it's over now. The coldness of his voice felt like a knife in her chest.
Why did you tell Leah about us? She asked.
Suddenly she wanted to know the answer desperately. If Gabriel hadn't confessed the affair, Leah and Danny would never have been with him on assignment in Vienna. I told her because I didn't want to lie to her. My entire life was a lie. Shamron had convinced me I was perfect, but I wasn't perfect. For the first time in my life I had behaved with a bit of human frailty and weakness. I suppose I needed to share it with her. I suppose I needed someone to forgive me. He picked up his coat. His face was twisted. He was angry, not with her, but with himself. You have a long day ahead of you tomorrow. His voice was all business now. Get settled and try to get some rest. Julian's expecting you at 9 o'clock. For a few minutes after he left, Jacqueline was distracted by the ritual of unpacking. Then the pain crept up on her, like the delayed sting of a slap. She collapsed onto the couch and began to cry.
What in the hell am I doing in this dreary little place?
She had agreed to come back for one reason, because she thought she could make Gabriel love her. But he had dismissed their affair in Tunis as a moment of weakness. Still, why had he come back after all these years to kill Tariq? Was it simply revenge? An eye for an eye? No, she thought. Gabrielle's motives ran far deeper and were more complex than pure revenge. Perhaps he needed to kill Tariq in order to forgive himself for what happened to Leah and finally move on with his life.
But will he ever be able to forgive me?
Perhaps the only way to earn his forgiveness was to help him kill Tariq.
And the only way I can help him kill Tariq is to make another man fall for me and take him to bed.
She closed her eyes and thought of Yusuf al-Tafiki. Gabriel had left his car on the Ashworth Road. He made a show of dropping his keys on the curb and groping in the darkness as if he were trying to find them. In reality, he was searching the undercarriage of the car, looking for something that shouldn't be there, a mass, a loose wire. The car looked clean, so he climbed in, started the motor, and drove in circles for a half hour to make certain he was not being followed. Only then did he drive back to Bayswater and park around the corner from his flat. As he walked quickly along the pavement toward his entrance, he looked up toward his window and murmured, "Good evening, Mr. Karp." And he pictured Karp, peering through the sight of his parabolic microphone, saying, "Welcome home, Gabe. Long time no hear from." Maida Vale, London. Jacqueline felt a peculiar exhilaration the following morning as she walked along Elgin Avenue toward the Maida Vale tube station. She had lived a life of hedonistic excess, too much money, too many men, fine things taken for granted. It felt reassuring to be doing something so ordinary as taking the underground to work, even if it was only a cover job. She bought a copy of The Times from the newsstand on the street, then entered the station and followed the stairs down to the ticket lobby. The previous evening she had studied street maps and memorized the underground lines. They had such curious names: Jubilee, Circle, District, Victoria. To get to the gallery in St. James's, she would take the Bakerloo line from Maida Vale to Piccadilly Circus. She purchased a ticket from an automated dispenser, then passed through the turnstile and headed down the escalator to the platform. So far, so good, she thought. Just another working girl in London. She was at the door to the gallery at 10 minutes before 9.
Julian Isherwood arrived 15 minutes later. When he realized who she was and why she was there, his mouth fell open slightly. To cover up his discomposure, he cleared his throat several times, rapidly.
"Your name is what again?" he said.
"I'm Dominique Bonnard."
"Yes, well, you're French," he said, as if he thought this might be a revelation to her. "I'm afraid my French is rather atrocious."
"I'm sure we'll get along just fine in English."
Finally, he managed to unlock the door. He held it open rather too gallantly and showed her her desk.
"There's a man called Oliver Dimbleby coming later this morning," Isherwood said as casually as he was able. "He looks rather like an English sausage in a Savile Row suit, but he may be important to me one of these days."
He handed her a pair of keys on a blue elastic band.
"These are for you. Whenever one of us leaves the gallery, the doors are to be armed. The disarm code is 576-497-326. Get that?"
Jacqueline nodded. Isherwood looked at her incredulously, and she repeated the sequence of numbers briskly and without error. Isherwood was clearly impressed.
"Well, let me show you around the rest of the gallery," he said.
He ushered her into a small lift, barely large enough to accommodate two passengers. He inserted his key into the security lock, turned it, and pressed the button marked B. The lift groaned and shuddered, then traveled slowly down the shaft, coming to rest with a gentle bump. The door opened, and they entered a cool, dark room.
"This is the tomb," he said, switching on the lights.
It was a cramped cellar filled with canvases, some framed, some unframed, and resting in slots built into the walls.
"My stockroom," he said. "Hundreds of works."
He led her back onto the lift, and this time they rode up. The door opened onto a large, high-ceilinged room under a glass skylight. Jacqueline felt as if she had stepped into a museum. There was a Venus by Luini and a Nativity by Del Vaga, a Baptism of Christ by Bordone, and a stunning landscape by Claude.
"Feel free to come up any time you like," Isherwood said in a new burst of gallantry. "Bring your lunch."
"I will. Thank you for showing it to me."
"If you're going to work here, I suppose you should know your way round the place."
They took the lift to the main level. Jacqueline sat at her new desk, pulled open the drawers, rummaged through the paper clips and pens, experimented with the copy machine. Isherwood said,
"You do know how to use those things, don't you?"
"I'm sure I'll get the hang of it."
"Oh, good Lord," he murmured.
Oliver Dimbleby arrived promptly at 11 o'clock. When he saw her, he pulled in his stomach.
"So, you're Julian's new girl," he said, shaking her hand. "I'm Oliver Dimbleby. Very pleased to meet you. Very pleased indeed."
"Come, Oliver," Isherwood called from the inner office. "Here, boy. Let go of her hand and get in here. We haven't got all day."
Oliver reluctantly relinquished her hand and stepped into Isherwood's office.
"Tell me, Julie, my love, if I actually buy this place, does that angel out there convey?"
"Oh, do shut up, Oliver."
Isherwood closed the door. Jacqueline went back to trying to figure out the fax machine. The telephone call arrived at the kebab factory at 4 p.m. Gabrielle waited 3 minutes and 20 seconds for Yusuf to come to the phone. He knew the precise amount of time it took because later he felt compelled to measure it with a stopwatch. During Yusuf's absence, he was treated to the sounds of the kitchen help, chattering in Lebanese Arabic, and Mohammed, the afternoon manager, screaming at a busboy to clear table 17. When Yusuf finally came to the phone, he seemed slightly out of breath. The entire subsequent conversation lasted 37 seconds. When it was done, Gabrielle rewound the tape and listened to it so many times Karp begged him to stop.
"Trust me, Gabe, there's nothing sinister going on. It's two guys talking about getting a drink and maybe finding a girl and getting laid. You remember getting laid, don't you?"
But Gabrielle was initiating the next phase of the operation. He was sending Jacqueline into hostile territory, and he wanted to be certain he wasn't sending her into a trap. so he listened again.
We still on for tonight?
Absolutely. Where?
Albar 1, Leicester Square, 9 o'clock.
I'll be there. Stop.